When this period starts, I first made contact with the FWBO in September, October 1973. And if I could just ask Andrew to stand up and come and stand by me. So he's about the same. He's about the same height as me, isn't he? So this is sort of what I looked like. But I had a big beard, no chin, and slightly longer hair. Well, much longer hair.
Longer hair.
Yeah. But you know, I was slender like this, and a young man, pretty much the same age as Andrew. So thank you, Andrew. Just to, unfortunately, I suppose in some ways my just a little bit of background to myself. But at this age, unlike Andrew, I was actually already married. I'd got married when I was 21, and during this period that we're looking at, in some ways, I think I was a sort of a bit of a dark horse. I was had a wife, and in 1973, actually had the first daughter born. So I was a little bit different from this bunch of people that you saw in the film. Although most of those people in the film are my sort of contemporaries. So I sort of grown up and matured in the order with a lot of those people. Vajradhaka, Subhuti, Lokamitra, Nagabodhi, Mangala, and several Dharmadina, several others. And I had a lot of contact with those people when I was first came into the order. I happened to marry someone called Jane Goody, who was the brother, the sister of Jeremy Goody, who at the time when the film starts wasn't an order member, but in 1973 he got ordained as Lokamitra. So Lokamitra was my brother-in-law, and it was a bit like I had family and friends who were in the FWBO. And I got dragged along to that centre, Pundarika. It wasn't Pundarika at the time, but it was the Buddhist Archway Centre, North London. I got dragged along there by Jeremy Goody, Lokamitra, and before he was ordained, and he said, "You must come and meet Bunty." And I didn't know who Bunty was. Later on, I discovered it was Banty, not Bunty, and I thought it was just his name. And and I went along to the centre. It was pretty much like those photographs with the cat on the couch, the tea bar, people milling around, a little bookshop. In some ways, it's quite reminiscent of most Buddhist centres. They seem to have followed a similar pattern. And even here in the Manchester Buddhist Centre, we've just got a more sophisticated and larger version of what was, you know, there in that centre. And sometimes in the winter, when I come into this building, it is reminiscent of the cold, damp shrine room of the Archway Centre. So it's, you know, some things don't change so quickly. So what to say about that period? I got involved in late 1973. When Banty was giving that series of lectures called The Tantric Path. So I came into a series of incredibly esoteric teachings of Buddhism. I don't think really anyone understood them, so I didn't feel alone. But it was one of those sort of feelings where you were just there listening to something, and something was going in and it was having an effect on you. And you just sort of got drawn in. And before I knew really where I was, moved to Cambridge I must have got involved in the movement actually in 72, and in 73 I moved to Cambridge, and my daughter was born shortly afterwards. And towards the end of that year, David Mitra, who was one of those characters in the photographs, he became a good friend of mine, and he said to me, "Why don't you get ordained?" So I said, I've more or less decided to, but I don't think I'm ready yet. And so I think I'll ask when I feel ready. So he said, no, you should just do it now. You know, don't wait. So This was after a period, just to get things in context. When I got involved in the movement, Bhante was giving this series of lectures and he taught me to meditate. Then after about 6 weeks or 8 weeks, he left. He went to Cornwall. He went to live in Cornwall. And I didn't see him again until about July the following year in 1973, when he happened to come up to Cambridge, where I had just moved. And there was the first ever men's retreat taking place in Loka Mitra's father's house in Cambridge. And I, one of my roles in life, in my first meetings with Bhante, was to be his driver. I was one of the few friends in those days who had a car. I lived this double life. In the day I was an engineer, and in the evenings I was a bit of a hippie. And I had enough money to own a car. And I used to drive him home after classes, and then he disappeared to Cornwall, and he came back, and then I was driving him around Cambridge a bit, and he disappeared again. And he moved up to Norfolk, and in January, straight after that Bodhicharya Avatara retreat, David Mitchell was so inspired. His inspiration must have set me alight, because I suddenly found myself meeting Bhante and saying, "Do you know, I've come to see you about Bhante?" And he said, "No." I said, "Can you guess?" He said, "Oh, I think so." So I said, "Well, I want to get ordained." He said, "Oh, totally good." So he told me about a new system called the Mitra system, and I became the first Mitra. You have to become a Mitra to get ordained. And 6 months later, I got ordained, so it was quite a simple process. And like Dharma Dinner, I had no idea what it was I was really letting myself in for. But to sort of share something with you of that time, it was... I guess a lot of people were operating much more on a sort of a heart connection rather than a clear rational level. Maybe it was the drugs, muddling their thinking. But it wasn't really like that. There was this sort of strong feeling of sangha, that you were with your friends and sort of family in a way. And it's easy to say, okay, well, it was just like a group pressure. You know, it's just like a cult, all these people were getting ordained, so the thing to do was to get ordained yourself. It certainly didn't feel like that, and even thinking back, you know, to that time, which is like nearly 40 years ago, it certainly didn't feel like that. It felt as though things just were following a natural course, and it was as though shortly after I was ordained, I had this sort of feeling as though I knew people much, much longer than this lifetime. So it was a bit like coming back into contact with a group of people that you somehow could just be with. Anyway, that was sort of on a personal level, and things for me didn't change an awful lot. I was a little bit probably a boring character. I wasn't very radical, certainly not up until the point of shortly after that period that my life became a bit more radical. So what was it like at that time? Well, it was England, it was London, and it was a very, very unusual time. First of all, you were expected to be completely sexually free. Most of us were blocked sexually, so it was this terrible tension between feeling that you were, you know, really cool and you're having lots of relationships but actually didn't have any, or you got married like me, and but you had to sort of, you know, you felt there was something wrong with you because you thought everyone else was having this free sort of life, and it was a very confusing and difficult time because it seems very good on when you look back at sort of interesting times perhaps, but it was rather confusing living through that time. But it was very, very exciting. It was as though you could suddenly break out of norms. I think I came from a generation where I saw my life just being like a set of railway tracks. You're just going to follow those tracks down. You meet someone, a partner. You decide to get married. You get a house. You have a family. The family grow up. And, you know, before you know where you are, you're a pensioner. And it just seemed like that's what you did. So I was just following on these railway tracks. But when I met Bhante in the FWBO, suddenly everything sort of came up for grabs, a whole new way of looking at things. So To give you some idea how important that time was in the founding of the FWBI, I remember asking Banti when I was about 10 years ago, 8 years ago. Banti wasn't very well. He was having a lot of sleep deprivation, and I was for a couple of months spending quite a bit of time with him, looking after him. And I had a few conversations with him, and we were talking about the founding of the Western Buddhist Order, and sort of, I think I was being a little bit, feeling a bit sad that things weren't quite like they used to be. And we were talking about, when he founded the movement. And I remember him saying something along the lines that it was the only time it would have been possible for him to start the FWBO in those conditions. That the conditions were just so right for the founding of a new Buddhist order in the late 60s, early 70s, that if he had missed it would have been impossible. So it was a rather sort of strange thing to say, and a strange thing to have happened. But it was like a window of opportunity opened up in history, where something could come from the East in the form of Sangha, actually happened to be an Englishman from Tooting, and be transplanted, and for it to blossom and grow and then start spreading all around the world again. And he was completely adamant about that, like this was back in the early 2000s. I was talking to him in 2003, and he really felt, looking back, it wouldn't have been possible. So it was that sort of particular time and situation. And I don't know if it could have happened in other towns or whatever, but North London, in the whole sort of Kentish Town, Camden area of North London, there was sort of a lot of alternative things going on. And people were just very, very open to trying out different new things. So I came along and made friends, seemed to get on very well with people, really liked people. And then I remember people moving into these squats. And I was born in a very working-class London family, and some of my family lived in sort of tenement buildings in Clerkenwell, which was very unpopular in those when I was born. It wasn't so wealthy as it is today. And they were, I think, what were technically called slums. And so people were moving into these houses, which reminded me of where my grandmother lived. And I had this revulsion against these squats. But the guys that moved into them absolutely loved it. I used to hate going there, because there would be rats and dirt. The guys that moved into them, and the girls, there was a women's community, it was a mixed communities, they just really loved it. And it was a sort of a whole new way of being. And it was really, really interesting, really good. However, it did have its downsides. So one of the things that the film doesn't show is, like all groups of people, there were enormous conflicts. One of the reasons why single-sex communities became quite popular is because it was a lot of young people, and it was very sort of acceptable that you could be a bit free with your relationships. So someone would be sleeping with one person one day, and then a couple of weeks later they were sleeping with another person, even some of those people in that film. I won't mention any names, but they were certainly swapping beds from time to time. And it creates enormous tensions, because just when you think you had a girlfriend, or the girlfriend thought she had a boyfriend, suddenly the boyfriend might be sleeping with another boyfriend, because it was all that time of sexual exploration of different cross-gender things. Your partner was sleeping with someone else, and it was like, hey man, it was all cool. It wasn't. It was very, very difficult and very tempting, and there was a lot of tensions and a lot of difficulties there. But it seemed as though, out of all this turmoil and confusion, that something new sort of began to grow and to take root. And when I joined the order, it was very, like Dharma Dinner said, you sort of learnt what it was to be an order member by osmosis. No one really told you. But I never, ever had any doubts I did the right thing. And I've never, ever had doubts in the whole of my 35 or something years as an order member that I did the wrong thing then. I'm really very, very pleased that I became an order member. So Sangharakshita was a unusual character. He's had this long hair when I met him. You know that bubbly sort of coat thing in one of the photographs? I remember him wearing that. And he's sort of, what they called, mutton chops, sideboards. And so when I walked into the first night at the Buddhist centre, Lokamitra said, "Hello, this is Bunty." And I thought Bunty was just another punter at the Buddhist centre. He didn't have his robes or anything. So I said, "Oh, yeah, hi, mate, how are you going?" And just chatted away to him. And then a little while later, he was upstairs in his robes and he was suddenly the teacher. So it was lovely sort of getting to know him in a, without sort of projecting anything onto him. And he was just a very, very unusual man. It was very difficult to pin him down to say exactly what it was. It was a bit like he was in, well, looking back on it now, it was as though he was in disguise, you know, like a secret agent, you know, just had it on a mission, who was just sort of fitting in and quite happy to be what he appears to be. He wasn't like exactly putting it on. But in another way, you don't really see the real man behind that. I remember on one occasion, just before I was ordained, I went to a puja in Norfolk, and just a few of us did this puja. And he did the sevenfold puja, he finished it, and then he just sat. We just sat, and he just sat. I think we sat there for about 2 hours, just waiting for him to ring the bell. And the atmosphere was absolutely amazing. First of all, it was like, first of all, thinking, when's he going to ring that bell? My legs are killing me. When's he going to ring that bell? Until you got to a point where you gave up thinking when he was going to ring that bell. And you just sort of sat there and you just sat. And it, that was the sort of person he was. He just did things very, very spontaneously and creatively. And I think that was a real sign of the times, which is something I've, you know, in many ways, really, looking back at my age of 61, looking back on those times, it's easy to say they were good old times, but I don't necessarily think of them like that. But what I think was good about them is the fact that as there were a lot of young people involved in the movement, and a lot of young people who were a bit leaderless. They had, Sangharakshita came along, organised things, went away, came back with a dream, and his dream was, let's start a Buddhist order. So what is that? I don't know. Let's just work it out as we go along. So it was a bit like there were no sort of definite guidelines, no rules, no regulations, no nothing to conform to. There was the five precepts, which one was expected to start understanding and putting them into place, and you had to work out exactly what that meant in terms of who you slept with and whether you took drugs or not and things like that. There was all these things which we were trying to work out for ourselves without some elder saying, thou shalt not, you know, drink alcohol if you're a, an order member or something like that. So it was very, very exciting times. And I think in a way it's something I would really like to see to come back more and more to our centres, and particularly with the younger people. I think when you've reached a certain age, it's you can be young at heart, but let's face it, you can't really be young. You know, people like, we like our comfort too much, and we sort of, you know, we like our security and things. But when you're young, ideally, I mean, I don't know about the young people today, because it does worry me. I think they worry too much about security and things like that. But it's a bit like having that sense of anything could happen. You just don't know. It's magic. You know, you can sort of do things and put things in place and try out wacky ideas, and you learn from your mistakes and you expose yourself. You have to be fearless that you're going to sort of like talk about the Dharma, and some, you know, some people do, and they perhaps talk incorrectly, but you get corrected, and it's a great way of being, is being, having that sort of courage and enthusiasm to be creative like that way, like that. The great thing about Sangharakshita, he was in his 40s at that time, and so he wasn't that old, but he was really encouraging us young people to just do things, to try out things. And I'd really like to, I know Andrew's organising a young people's group around the centre, but I think it's something all of us who are a bit older could really encourage young people to do, is, you know, is be more creative and more imaginative in how to practice the Dharma. So I didn't really structure a talk, as you might have gathered, before I saw the film, because I have seen the film before, but I couldn't really remember exactly what was on there. And as I say, it was a sort of a time for me where things were just beginning to grow a bit under the surface, and it was after this period that some big changes took place in my own life. So I think maybe it'd be better if I just open the floor to any questions, and sort of if there's any particular aspects of that time you're interested in, I could try to answer your questions.
So it wasn't until Sangharaksha came back from Cornwall that he actually used the word order.
No, he used the word order in 1967 because he started the Western Buddhist Order then. So he already had this idea of a new Buddhist order. It was when he went back to India in the mid-60s and he got this letter from Christmas Humphreys and the Buddhist Society saying, you are not welcome back, don't bother coming back, we don't want you anymore, we're not going to support you. When he decided, well, you know what this means, he said that to his friend Terry Delamere. What this means is a new Buddhist order. So he knew from mid-60s that that's what he was going to do. And he used the word the Western Buddhist Order. But I think it was much more the movement, the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, of like what that was going to be like was a bit more unknown. There was no idea of communities, no idea of people living and practicing together, and so on. Last Sunday we had a Sangha, not this Sunday, Sunday before, we had a Sangha retreat at Castleton. And one of the things I noticed on that, like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when all the clearing up had been done, and you think people were just dying to get off home, no one wanted to leave. In Vidyamala said, right, we're off now. And everybody said, okay, bye, you know. And everyone was still there eating their apple strudel that Patricia had done. But it reminded me of those early days. It reminded me, like, I was expecting someone to say, wouldn't this be a good way to live? And that's actually how the first community started. People went on retreats and they thought, wow, this is really great. You know, it's not always great when you know. But personally, I preferred the conflicts and the difficulties to the isolation of being alone. So that's the sort of thing that happened. You went on retreat, you thought, this was great. Shouldn't we live like this all the time? And then people said, yeah, okay. And in a way, when you're young in that state, you haven't got much to lose. Of course, most of those people lost their education, but people like myself, no, not myself, but quite a few people dropped out of university or just finished university and then never had a career. Like Subhuti's never had a career working in the world. He's always been a Buddhist and as an order member. Lokamitra, pretty much the same, and so on. That's right, yeah. It was as though there was this sort of group of people who knew one another. And I tell you, some of the times the tension between, there was a threesome that worked together running the Buddhist centre just before Sukhavati was built. And the tension between those people was like, you could almost see it in the air, like a black cloud, and people just really couldn't get on with one another. But somehow this sort of tension was like caused a sort of creative friction, which resulted in Sukhavati being built. Eventually, Lokamitra moved out of that situation. Perhaps it's obvious he was one of them. And went off to India. And people did, you know, Banti said things to people like, oh, I think you should go to Glasgow and like go to me or to New Zealand. And people just did it. You know, it seemed like the most natural thing in the world to do. Not that you felt you were told to do it. It was just like, I suppose you felt a bit honoured that someone actually believed in you that much. Because you certainly didn't believe in yourself that much. It was a bit like someone said, well, you can run a centre, just go and do it. And you, okay, I'll go and do it.
Did your wife get involved?
Yeah, my wife got ordained a year after me. And she became an order member, still is an order member. And she's, in fact, the Goody family produced three older members, and one Mitra. There's only one sibling who's not a Buddhist, who my daughters really admire. They're normal. I can't remember people ever thinking like that. I think it was just that I suppose there was a tremendous optimism at that time in the world. On the one hand, I mean, you know, it's just to get things into context, right? Now you think there's global warming and, you know, it's a catastrophe, maybe recession, things like that. In the early 70s, no one expected to ever get to the year 2000 because it was a Cold War. And it was like... no one expected for the world to ever to survive that long. So it was a sort of pessimistic, on the one hand, there was, you know, America and Russia posed with all their thousands of atomic weapons ready to fire them at one another, and Europe was sort of in the middle of it. And there was this sort of sense, well, the end is nigh. But there was at the same time a strange optimism that actually you could do anything. It was as though, I don't know whether you had this feeling, it didn't matter anyway because it was all going to end, but it was a bit like you could try out anything, you could do anything. And so I don't think people felt that if whatever we did, it might all fall apart, because it's a bit like, well, if it fell apart, you just do it, build it up again. Yeah. And in a way, when things are small, there isn't that much to lose. You can just start again. It's when you've got big buildings and big organisations and systems and things like that, when it all starts to fall to pieces, it all gets a bit worrying because you, you know, don't know what's going to happen. A friend of mine said to me the other day, Dai Marla might not like to hear this, but he said to me the other day that probably the best thing that could happen to the Buddhist Centre is to sell it and then get everyone to build new centres around Manchester, because it's sort of like having something. I mean, there are definitely advantages, because that's why we sold it, to having a big Buddhist centre, a big, like, big flagship. But sometimes when people are in smaller situations where everyone has to muck in and do things, it brings out the best in you. So instead of worrying about you and your weaknesses, and like Subhuti said, your psychological problems, you just get over yourself, basically, because if you want to be involved, you just have to do things. And it would be a bit like that. It would be a bit like the trustee saying, OK, the best thing for you is to sell the building, give you all, you know, little groups of you, a couple of £1,000, and just say, go on, go and build a Buddhist centre, you know, here and here and there. You could have Buddhist centres dotted all around. I must say, when I start thinking like that, I can feel this sort of excitement coming back. Oh, that'd be good. Where should I go in Manchester to start my Buddhist centre? And so on. So it would be a bit like that. And as I say, there are advantages to having, you know, established things. People get much better training. People, we have lost a number of people on the way, but the number of people who have left the order is relatively few, given most people didn't know what they were letting themselves in for. I think one of the things I've noticed is that if I take a starting point that I'm old and I'm not going to change my life very much, but I'm going to really encourage young people to change their life, it puts me back in touch with what it was like when I was young. And then before I know where I am, I'm starting to think like a young person again. So I think it's a bit like taking account of the fact, well, okay, I can't pretend I'm a young person, but how do I sort of reignite that sort of spirit of being young, of being a bit wacky and a bit, you know, less sort of conservative and sort of, and so forth. How do I do it? Well, if I look around and I think, well, I'd like to encourage young people, I think, well, what would I encourage him to do? That you start, I start experiencing this sort of distance between me and them somehow. And I have to use my imagination to become like them. And I think in doing that, I become young again. So I don't think one needs to feel left out, but you will be left out if you think like an old person. You know, if you think like an old person, like you just got to put your feet up, take it easy, not do too much, retire, and so on, you'll become an old person who's putting their feet up, not doing too much, and retiring. Whereas if you think like you could be a young person, of course you can't run around with all the energy of a young person, particularly if you've got, you know, sort of limitations to your health and so on. But you can actually have a spirit of being young. And one of the things I noticed with Banti, he was never running around like a young person, but he was always encouraging creativity and youthfulness and vitality in people, and bringing that alive. And I think when that comes about, it affects everyone. It's like having, if we had lots more young people around the centre, us older people would perhaps feel a little bit uncomfortable sometimes, but if we opened ourselves to that sort of energy, it will ignite us and you know, sort of like make us feel more energetic ourselves, more enthusiastic about life and so on. So that's how I see things anyway. It's, I don't feel excluded, and I've even asked to join the young people's group. Yeah, well, I think what I would do, you see, if I was thinking a bit more radically, I would start the old people who are young group. Because, you know, it's an old person's way of looking is to feel left out. So if you feel young in at heart, you don't feel left out, you actually create your own sort of group. So that's exactly the sort of challenges that were there in the early days. That no one, people felt victims and things like that. If they were felt like victims, they had to do something about it. No one was going to do it for you. And I think in a way that would be good if we could develop that attitude in the Buddhist centre. That if you're not happy with something, it's not quite suiting you, create something new for yourself. You know, if you don't like this Buddhist centre, go and start another one somewhere. You know, it's almost like if we thought like that, it would probably release more energy in ourselves. That's my idea. Well, I think that's always a danger that we bring in, you know, our views from the outside society, where you see it happening all the time, into the Sangha. And I think it's something we have to be really, we really have to guard against. I mean, it's not as though we want to deconstruct everything here, because as I say, there's a lot of value in it. But I think what we need to really value is creativity. And a creative sort of urge to do things. So there may be better and new ways of doing things. And I think I'd like to see the Buddhist centre as being different from society. One of the marks, one of the great teachings of Sangharakshita is the teaching of the individual. And Sangharakshita talks about the individual as being not part of the mass of humanity. So the individual, and particularly the true individual, the enlightened individual, is set apart from the mass of humanity. It's not that you don't interact with humanity, but actually you create something that is different from humanity. And what we need to be careful of in the centre is that we don't just become an extension of the Manchester city in our centre. That actually, when people come through the door, a lot of people notice it's a beautiful building inside, it's got a calmness and so on. But it... In a way, I would see the centre as being, as growing into a place where, those Buddhists, they're pretty weird. You know, they really do things differently. And it's a bit like you come into that, and then the weird people come in. Not the sort of necessarily a down and out type weird people, but the creative weird people come in and think, wow, this is cool, you know. And you sort of feel there's a place in there for you. In a way, society hasn't changed at all. You know, when I was young, people used to worry about security, what they're going to do when they get old, you know, how, bringing up a family and all those things. But when people came into the movement when they were younger, they stopped worrying about things like that. And when Vidyamala and I were in Sydney a few weeks ago, we met an older member who's a little bit older than me, but she's got this sort of... she had this sort of youthfulness about her that I just found so refreshing. We were asking, well, what are you going to do if you have to move out of this place you're living in? She's living in a beautiful house that another older member built in the country outside of Sydney. And she said, I don't know, just we might get asked to leave in 3 years, and she didn't seem at all bothered. And it was a bit like, oh wow, you know. And she was completely generous. She was,
had no money.
She gave us money because she wanted us to have a room, an extra a few hours in the hotel room in Singapore for Vidya Mala's back. And she was giving away a last bit of money. It was like, she didn't care, you know, didn't matter. It was, it wasn't sort of, irresponsible, not caring. It was just like a confidence that something would turn up. And one of the things I've noticed going, you know, through the 80s and the 90s is that a lot of younger people have just been sort of so conditioned into thinking, you know, about security and what you're going to do when you get old and, you know, what happens to you when you haven't got, when you're old and you've got no money. We get ill usually and then you get put in the hospital and you die. It's a sort of, you know, pretty straightforward. But people worry about it, you know, is it going to be the right conditions? I better save up for 20 years so that when I'm dying it's sort of comfortable. And I think people certainly came out of the Buddhist, you know, at my time, didn't have, I think some of us may have developed that view later on, but certainly at that age you didn't worry. And by and large people don't have to worry. It's sort of, you know, it, society will provide you with things. If society doesn't provide you with something, you create a new society that will. It's a bit like thinking like that, really, rather than thinking, oh yeah, it sounds all very well, but, and then all the big buts come in, and nothing ever happens because there are all these buts all the time. It's a bit like saying, well, you know, I'm not going to bother about the buts, I'm just going to do something, and when I've lived my life, I think, wow, that was a life worth living. And, you know, if you're in poverty at the end of it, you still think that was a life worth living, rather than sitting in your comfortable armchair in your centrally heated flat, all alone, thinking, oh, well, is this it? And so I think that was the sort of, just trying to communicate the sort of atmosphere of what it was like when I was young.